And to get started, I'd like to introduce a close friend of the Federalist Society who will introduce Judge Webster. Mr. Boyden Gray is counselor to the Vice President and has been very helpful to us in terms of giving us advice and being a friend of the Society. And I'd like to introduce Boyden now.
Thank you very much. I'm glad my advice means something. I'm not sure it always does. It's always it's a real honor to introduce Judge Webster, in no small part because everybody knows him, so I don't have to talk for very long. He is, as everyone knows, really Mr. Integrity, and I also want to say why I think he ought to be known as Mr. Courage as well. He went to Amherst, Washington University, law school. He's a native of St. Louis. Was in private practice for a while, then became, after the war, U.S. attorney, U.S. district judge for 3 years, 1970-73, then went on the Eighth Circuit until he was appointed head of the FBI in 1978. Now, as we all know, judgeship, whether it's a district court or circuit court, is a tenured job. And so it took a little courage, I think, to go to the FBI. But we all know, too, I think J. Edgar Hoover taught us that the FBI is also a tenured job in a way. And so to go to the CIA, which is definitely not, is why I think we should call him Mr. Courage. The CIA is enormously important. The Judge Webster's decision to go there is, I suppose, in a funny way, in a small way, a reflection of the importance of the rule of law has in this whole field, good news and bad news. The bad news is, I suppose, that we need to have so many lawyers looking at that carefully at what happens. The good news is that I'll put in a plug for my old law firm. He brought over a former partner of mine from Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, I want you to all know. But there is, I think, something courageous in going to an institution which has been buffeted. And I know something about this, not just because I work for someone who had his job for a year, but my father spent his life in the intelligence world, was Eisenhower's last NSC advisor, worked for and with the CIA most all of his life. I think he felt this is the most important thing he could do with his life. And United States without a powerful and effective intelligence community has no power and no defense whatsoever. So without saying anything more, Judge Webster.
Many thanks, Boyden. It's good to be with all of you today. I'm not sure how much of an intelligence officer I am yet, having had the lack of prescience to bet heavily on my St. Louis Cardinals and then accept a speaking invitation at Twin Cities last weekend. But anyway, I think I'm in a more friendly group today, and I'm glad to be here. I particularly appreciated Professor Moore making room for me and caught the last several minutes of his address this morning, and I must say that it struck a very responsive chord for someone who has to deal with the other branch of government. The events of the past several months have raised anew questions in the United States about secret operations and whether such activity is appropriate in a democracy such as ours. What we've learned and what I want to discuss with you today are the circumstances under which the use of secret intelligence can not only be very appropriate and necessary, but a vitally important part of our national security. I think that what I have to say fits into a consideration of the role of the branches of government with respect to foreign policy, because much of what we do deals with the gathering of information upon which policymakers can make wise decisions in that area, and then, in specific cases, taking action to implement that foreign policy. Not CIA foreign policy, but that foreign policy. Not long ago, somebody gave me a lapel button that read, "My job is so secret that even I don't know what I'm doing." Well, possibly true. But there may be some correlation between that statement and how we feel about secrecy. It conjures up images of Orwellian intrusion by government, of clandestine activities that put at risk our most cherished individual liberties, of mistakes and blunders concealed within documents classified as secret or eyes only. There is, of course, a historical basis for all of these concerns, including some very recent history. But that's really not my purpose in speaking to you today. Rather, I propose to talk about the collection of intelligence at home and abroad and how our Constitution, without a single reference to intelligence, has accommodated this function so vital to our national security and has inspired a system of oversight through the separation of powers. Taking a leaf or two from my experiences on the federal bench and as director of the FBI, I conduct my responsibilities today with two cardinal theses. First, that the intelligence activities vital to the protection and preservation of our national security must be conducted professionally, objectively, and lawfully, with absolute fidelity to our Constitution and to our laws. And second, there must be a trustworthy system of oversight and accountability which builds rather than erodes trust between those who have the intelligence responsibility and those who act as surrogates for the American people. Intelligence has always played a major role in our history and is at least as old as our Constitution. A couple of years ago, Malcolm Forbes gave Bill Casey and me a copy of a letter from George Washington, written in 1779 to Major Talmage, in which he outlines some of his thoughts on the need for and the requirements of good intelligence work. And I'm also reminded that earlier in 1777, Washington wrote to Colonel Elias Dayton discussing the need for intelligence in these words. He wrote, "The necessity of procuring good intelligence is apparent and need not be further urged. All that remains for me to add is that you keep the whole matter as secret as possible. For upon secrecy, success depends in most enterprises of this kind, and for want of it, is generally defeated." In 1789, secret funding for foreign intelligence activities was formalized by the Congress in the form of a secret contingency fund for use by the President. Today, our government depends heavily upon accurate intelligence, intelligence to formulate and conduct our foreign policy, intelligence to verify the arms agreements that we have made, and to determine whether or not we could verify the arms agreements that may be signed in the future, and intelligence to understand both the military capabilities and the intentions of our adversaries, and more recently to deal with the twin scourges of narcotics and terrorism. Our primary consumers today are the President, the Vice President, the Secretaries of State, Defense, Treasury, the National Security Council, and of course, the select committees of the Senate and of the House. We learn at great cost that intelligence must be timely. In July, I spent a day in NORAD in Cheyenne Mountain at Colorado Springs, which is one of the principal early warning systems for our national defense. A day there can't help but make one aware of how important is early and accurate intelligence for our national defense. Just last week, I was at SAC, the Strategic Air Command in Omaha, where the same message came through loud and clear. Much time has passed since our Constitution was formed. And now in terms of survival warnings, we think in terms of minutes rather than in months and in years. a visit to the Middle East with a view of the East and West Bank and the Golan Heights and all the armament assembled there, the borders of Israel and Jordan and Syria, impress upon me the importance of our understanding and gathering reliable and timely intelligence. And the same true, of course, in the tactical situation in the Persian Gulf. The forms of intelligence vary from human intelligence that we're all aware of, clandestine intelligence, and the gathering of public source information around the world, to signals and communications intelligence, and imagery intelligence, some of which involve satellites, where a substantial amount of our budget is being spent. It's important that information that is collected be developed in an objective way, that the Director of Central Intelligence and the people who analyze the information can be seen as giving our best estimates, not to cook the books or to shape or influence policy, but to provide policymakers with the kind of information that they need to make the best interests, the best decisions, and the best judgments in the interest of our national security. In addition to collection and analytical activities, the CIA plays a role in the implementation of foreign policy, and this is done through our covert action programs. And it seemed like a good opportunity with this audience and this subject to discuss it with you. These may include political work through communications, getting the message out, may include training, supplying important materials for those whom we support, and giving advice. It's funny that although covert action is not defined by law, and I think that's the funny part, the term has come to be understood as referring to activities conducted in support of national foreign policy objectives in such a way that the role of the United States is not readily apparent. Covert capability, essential in our foreign policy, provides needed support for liberation movements, often provides support to governments, and allows us to work in collaboration with governments who do not wish, for legitimate political reasons of their own, to have the United States' role and involvement publicly known in their countries. From President Franklin Roosevelt forward, every president has endorsed and used covert action to support the policy, the foreign policy of this country. Although covert actions traditionally claim only a very small part of the CIA's budget, less than 3%, they are, of course, the focus of the greatest congressional and public attention. And having seen some of the responsibilities for covert action move outside the CIA into the National Security Council, I can understand how this has added to the confusion, the suspicion, and the ill ease of the American people. I have heard this situation described as a government without rules, inside a government that did not know. Since responsibility for covert action has come back to the CIA, never to leave again, I hope, I'd like to convince you today that we do have rules that, if followed by men of integrity and dedication, will meet the constitutional requirements and sustain our national security needs. We must, of course, have secrecy. Both Congress and the judiciary have recognized the need for secrecy in matters of national security. In the Freedom of Information Act, for instance, there are express provisions protecting from disclosure those matters of foreign counterintelligence and information supplied to us by foreign intelligence agencies. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, for instance, which is the act under which all of our electronic surveillance of counterintelligence takes place in this country, provides for a special court to review in secret the applications filed to conduct electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes. This statute has been found to be within the confines of the Constitution. The main purpose of secrecy in these efforts is to preserve and protect sources and methods, two of the most important words in the intelligence world. If we cannot protect our sources, whether they're FBI informants or CIA assets developed around the world, we will not get the information that we need. If we cannot protect the sensitive methods by which we collect that information, both in terms of individuals on the ground and satellites in the air, we will cease to have the means of collecting information. But while secrecy is necessary in these circumstances, there are nevertheless official surrogates looking after the interests of the American people. In 1976 and 1977, both houses of Congress established intelligence oversight committees to monitor all significant intelligence activities and expenditures. We find many of the rules which govern our activities in the National Security Oversight Act, the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, and the Intelligence Oversight Act. For example, the oversight committees operating under those acts have formalized the reporting of intelligence and covert activities to Congress. The intelligence community is now required by law to keep the Congress and the intelligence committees of the Congress fully and currently informed of all intelligence activities. Under the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, the President must find that each covert action is important to the national security before the operation can be initiated. We call that a finding, and you've been reading about it. Under law, it is our duty to notify the committees of any significant intelligence activities, which include any activities requiring a finding under the Hughes-Ryan Amendment. So now, under the statute, to meet extraordinary circumstances affecting vital national interests, the President can limit the notification to the chairman and ranking minority member of the intelligence committees, to the speaker and the minority leader of the House of Representatives, and to the majority leader and minority leader of the Senate, referred to in trade parlance as the Gang of Eight. And there's another statutory requirement that the intelligence committees be fully informed in a, quote, timely fashion of intelligence activities in foreign countries other than those solely for the purpose of collecting intelligence for which prior notice was not given. And the President must state the reasons for not giving prior notice in those circumstances. Tightly framed procedures for getting the information to the surrogates of the American people in a proper and in a timely way. I think we're improving the management capability to deal with covert activity on the executive side. It is not enough just for the President to make a finding authorizing and directing us to take some covert activity. Before submitting the proposal to the President, we in the intelligence community have a responsibility to determine that it is doable and doable in a lawful way. We must be sure that the individuals who are out on the firing line, in many instances, outside the reach and protection of our Constitution and our laws, can do the work in accordance with the flexibility that they need, with the clearest possible training and understanding of their responsibilities to the CIA and to the country. Our own internal covert action review group within the CIA now looks carefully at all aspects of covert finding and asks itself these kinds of questions. Is it consistent with the overt United States foreign policy? The kinds of things that went wrong in the Iran-Contra situation. Will it work? Not all covert activities will work, and we have to assess it. Will it work? What are the consequences going to be if the activity is publicly exposed? Will it make sense to the American people? Is it consistent with American values? Well, while not all covert activities are going to succeed, I think that if subjected to these kinds of tests and this kind of management, we have the best chance of getting the most effective and productive use from our covert capability. And all of these questions should be addressed again when the proposal goes to the National Security Council, often with the President in attendance for its consideration and recommendation. As I noted earlier, our relationship with the Congress must be one of truth and not of deception. There's so much confusion about deniability and deception that I think it's important to make one legitimate distinction. In covert activity, there is often deception to conceal the source of the activity in order to implement our foreign policy through means that we believe to be appropriate, but which must be necessarily covert. But in dealing with the Congress, there is absolutely no excuse for deception. Now, there are going to be occasions, I believe, when I may not be in a position to respond to a particular question, especially in an open session of the Congress. But I believe it is possible to tell the members of Congress, and I have done so on occasion, that I'm just not at liberty to answer the question, that I have an answer, but that I cannot give it. I think this is a lot different than trying to answer the question narrowly or acutely when I know what the Congress wants to hear from me, or pretending that they have failed to ask the question precisely enough. I think we have an obligation to speak to each other as individuals doing business, knowing what each other wants to know and being honest about what we are going to tell them or not tell them. If I decline to answer for reasons that seem legitimate to me, there are always opportunities to elevate that issue, for Congress to appeal over my head, or they may make it rough enough on me that I might conclude that I had to answer. But a level of honesty, a recognition that nothing is being withheld by deception, is vitally important in the relationship of the balance and the sharing of power. And I must say also that I think there is a corresponding obligation on the Congress and the committees who serve as surrogates inside the select committees to take into account the needs of secrecy and to share that responsibility with the same care and concern for the protection of our sources and methods that is imposed upon us in the executive branch. The challenges that we face in intelligence require a high degree of cooperation, not only within government, but outside it as well. And one of the key elements of our society, and one that's always been important to us, is the American academic community. As some of you may know, academics were at the beginning of our modern intelligence system. Professors and scholars flocked to Washington to become the backbone of the Office of Strategic Services in World War II, and many of them stayed around to create the CIA in 1947. They became key research directors, operations officers, managers, and leadership, and their legacy is still with us. Today, we rely very much on colleges and universities, not only to supply the new people who make our system work, but also for the expertise that they can provide us in so many areas. Many faculty members work closely with us, and some even become scholars in residence, sharing their knowledge on a day-to-day basis. There are at least 43 colleges and universities where a course in intelligence will be taught this year, and many others where a discussion of intelligence will take place in a course on foreign policy making. Agency officers are invited and do participate in professional and scholarly associations and make substantive presentations on campuses all over the country. There's nothing secret in these relationships, nor should there be. We believe that there can and there should be a close working relationship between the academic community and the intelligence community in developing accurate assessments about the world around us. We recognize that the campus is also a legitimate place for discussion and for dissent. Over the past few years, students and faculty opposed to the administration's policies have chosen the CIA and its recruiters as the targets for many of their protests. On one occasion, they even came to our own CIA agency campus in Virginia. But despite this activity, we continue to seek out the best and the brightest on our nation's campuses to join us, and they continue to come. Bob Gates has been at Princeton recently, and a week or so ago, I was at Dartmouth, and pleased to see both the interest and the support that exists on a campus noted for its capacity for dissent when issues are rationally and clearly and accurately presented to them. Well, I believe, in conclusion, that shared responsibility for intelligence is vitally important, both on the executive and on the congressional side. In the intelligence community, we must work closely with those in the executive branch who must make the policy recommendations that define our present and shape our future, providing our assessments objectively, professionally, helping to put truth into action. And we must work with the congressional committees which act in secret matters as surrogates for the Congress and the American people, and we must be worthy of their trust. And we must diligently carry out our assignments around the world, however difficult, with fidelity to the Constitution and the laws of our beloved country. No nation dedicated to the rule of law can protect itself in any other way. Thank you. I'm not sure what your schedule is, but I'd be very happy to take questions until whistle's blown on me. Yes.
Recently, there was a book published called Deep Black, which reputedly contained classified information about our intelligence gathering capabilities. How damaging is an event like this, and what can we do to try and prevent it in the future?
I'd rather not talk about any particular book, but I can give you a general answer. Books which reveal classified information can cause a great deal of damage to us. They can help to identify sources. They can help to identify the means by which intelligence was collected. Maybe it became a matter of knowledge in a particular country or area, but it's still being used effectively elsewhere. And so there's all the potential for defeating a legitimate purpose. I've never believed in trying to hide behind wrongdoing. Through secrecy or confidentiality. In fact, Congress will always be able to get from me anything it needs when it believes that there's a question of whether we're engaged in something we shouldn't be doing. But it's very important to protect our sources and our methods. It's hard to blame the writer more than we blame those who supplied the writer with the information. But those who were given the information in trust and betrayed it have, in fact, betray their country. Yes.
Yes, you said that your agency is going to be deeply involved in the determination of the ability to verify treaties. Of course, that's going to be a very important issue. The proposed treaties that are coming, you might want to comment on what you think about the likelihood of adequate verification in these proposed treaties. But with regard to one that that Mr. Gates spoke about a year ago, declassifying some information about the Soviets' development of an anti-ballistic missile system. He basically said in a speech that I think was given just about a year ago right now that the Soviets were preparing to be able to deploy a nationwide ABM system utilizing laser technologies and so forth. And this has seemed to have almost no impact on the current Congress, on the ABM treaty, and so on. And I'm just wondering why that would be the case.
I can't answer your question specifically because I probably saw that Bob's speech at the time he gave it. I'm not sure where it fits precisely here. The big problem that we're confronting is first making the decision makers, the policy makers, aware of both our strengths and our weaknesses in verification potential, because that responsibility will be a part of the intelligence community, including not just the CIA, but NSA, DIA, and all of the other military components of the intelligence community. We have been giving that information to the policymakers and to the National Security Council, and those policies are being made with knowledge of our strengths and of our weaknesses. What is frankly concerning me at the present time is how we're going to deal with 500 secretaries of state if and when there is a treaty submitted to the Senate, when everyone will want to be personally briefed on what, or may want to be personally briefed on all of the strengths and weaknesses in our verification. We're going to have to find a way of giving at least quantitative information to the members of Congress who will be called upon to vote on those issues, in a way that they will have the confidence that they need to make a judgment. At the same time, protect from public or foreign hostile intelligence awareness those weaknesses which we clearly have. their risks associated with arms control agreements, very significant risks. They're measured against the benefits and the promise of a more peaceful world. But there are risks, and they're made worse if our weaknesses are publicly exposed or exposed in a way that those on the other side can know them. Yes.
So I appreciate your work through the legislation. Part of our problem is, I'm aware of what we are, that there are many things that we do to be happy with regulation instead of being, which would exclude this kind of intelligence activity considered vital and important. Things like Alan Bell, which is located in the assassination of Hitler. It is a permissible question, even in the present climate, to ask if the legislation could be rewritten, or is there any legislation which would be changed before you come to the health state that is concerned with the national interest and not so much with the present climate. And not the same as a concern with legalistic questions as well.
I appreciate the question, but I don't think you can answer it without giving recognition to the present climate. Our society goes through evolutions in its concepts of decency and what is permissible and what is not permissible. And those, of course, are deeply affected by war and the threat of war and the imminence of war. At the present time, I cannot think of anything, and I'm sure there are, but I'm not thinking about them, of any kinds of legislative changes that would relieve us of a major burden. I am of the view that, as I tried to point out today, that the regulations and rules and procedures that are in place are workable and work with us, provided that we staff ourselves with men of and women of integrity. And respect for law, but I think that it is important that in the competition between the branches of government, we don't find ourselves and the intelligence community, with all its sensitive and perishable information and methods, caught in a squeeze between people's claims of rights to know and abilities to threaten to go public on some issue or to reveal secret matters that could put lives at risk or ruin programs. It comes down to people and an attitude about whether they can work together. And I guess that's my principal theory, that if we can develop trust, a greater level of trust between those of us who have to collect the information and implement the foreign policies through covert action, which incidentally has been not only, it's not our brainchild, I hope you got it clear, that it goes through a process in which all of the major heads of government and the president have approved it, and Congress has been informed about it. So it's not Congress suddenly finding something that it had never heard of before. But you've got to have a trust relationship developing so that in the adversarial process, we won't be subjected to the kinds of things that make it impossible for us to carry out our responsibilities. Want to call it? All right, fine. Yeah, there's a lot more good things coming for you this afternoon. Thank you for having me here.